From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The situation from a humanitarian standpoint is a catastrophe. We have something which is close to a million cases of suspected cholera maybe by the end of the year.
The whole structure, the whole general public services is really disintegrating in Yemen.
In Yemen, the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war has sparked the worst cholera outbreak in modern world history. We'll speak with California Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna, who's demanding the U.S. stop the unconstitutional war in Yemen. Then to California, where at least 40 people have died, hundreds are missing, thousands of homes have been destroyed by uncontrollable wildfires.
I saw this wall of flame come over the hill. I jumped in my car. Some neighbors across the valley from me saw me drive down, and the flames overtook the entire house. It was that close.
We'll speak with UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain and Mendocino County resident Jan Hoyman, who narrowly escaped the fires. Then, has the Trump administration launched COINTELPRO 2? We'll look at a leaked FBI report claiming black identity extremists pose a violent threat to police officers. Civil rights groups have slammed the FBI memo as the government's excuse to enact a new wave of repression against black activists. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Somalia's capital city of Mogadishu, two massive truck bombs exploded in quick succession Saturday night, killing at least 300 people, wounding 300 more. It was the deadliest attack in Somalia since the rise of the al-Shabaab militant group a decade ago, one of the worst bombings by a non-state actor in recent years. In the worst of the two bombings, a truck packed with hundreds of pounds of explosives detonated near the Safari Hotel, collapsing the building, igniting a nearby fuel tanker. The resulting fireball set cars on fire, flattened nearby businesses and homes, trapping people under rubble. On Sunday, hundreds of Somalis poured into the streets of Mogadishu to condemn the attacks. This is Rama Abdi Ali, one of the protesters.
It was a massacre that happened yesterday, and I never saw such a thing in the last 27 years. I witnessed a little boy's head laying on the ground and his mother and other children with their heads also cut in the explosion. People buried people's body parts separately because they collect them separately. It was a very shocking event.
Somalia's president declared 3 days of national mourning after the attacks. There's been no claim of responsibility, but Somalia's government was quick to blame al-Shabaab militants who've been behind past bombings in Mogadishu. The explosions came after the Trump administration stepped up a U.S. campaign against al-Shabaab in Somalia. In March, President Trump declared Somalia a so-called zone of active hostilities, giving wide latitude to military leaders to launch airstrikes and ground assaults. In May, that led to the first U.S. combat death in Somalia since 1993, when Navy SEAL officer Kyle Milliken was killed in an assault on an al-Shabaab radio station. In August, a raid by U.S. soldiers and Somali troops on a village outside Mogadishu left 10 civilians dead, including 3 children. President Trump said Friday he would refuse to certify Iran's compliance with an international nuclear deal, calling on Congress to toughen the U.S. stance toward Iran. Trump reportedly wanted to withdraw the U.S. completely from the Seven-Nation Agreement, but was talked out of it by Defense Secretary James Mattis and other members of his cabinet. This is U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley speaking on Meet the Press Sunday.
Well, I think right now you're going to see us stay in the deal, because what we hope is that we can improve the situation. And that's the goal. So I think right now we're in the deal to see how we can make it better. And that's the goal. It's not that we're getting out of the deal. We're just trying to make the situation better so that the American people feel safer.
Trump's move to undermine the Iran nuclear deal drew fire from U.S. allies, who said it increased the threat of war and made it far more likely Iran could develop nuclear weapons. In Tehran, President Hassan Rouhani condemned President Trump's decision.
Manners and attitude have great importance. President Trump's speech was full of falsehoods, unfair insults, lies, and fake accusations against the great Iranian nation. Iran is not a nation that will yield to forceful talking and hateful speeches from a dictator. The Iranian nation will not surrender to any nation.
In Washington, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Sunday he approved of President Trump's foreign policy moves, shrugging off comments by Republican Senator Bob Corker that Trump had, quote, castrated his Secretary of State. Speaking with CNN's Jake Tapper, Tillerson said he was fully intact. Tillerson also repeatedly refused to confirm the NBC report that he called Trump a moron during a meeting with top military officials last July.
Is it true? Did you call him a moron?
Jake, as I indicated earlier when I was asked about that, I'm not going to deal with that kind of petty stuff. I mean, this is a town that seems to relish gossip, rumor, innuendo, and they feed on it. They feed on one another in a very destructive way. I don't work that way. I don't deal that way.
In California, the death toll from unprecedented wildfires has risen to at least 40, with hundreds more missing, as firefighters continue to battle 15 major blazes across the state. The fires have destroyed thousands of homes and businesses and are now the deadliest in California since record-keeping began. At least 100,000 people have been forced to evacuate, with about 75,000 people still displaced. Later in the broadcast, we'll go to California for the latest on the wildfires. In Ireland, the remnants of Hurricane Ophelia made landfall Monday as a post-tropical cyclone, bringing gusts of more than 100 miles per hour and knocking out power to tens of thousands of people. Ophelia made history by becoming a Category 3 hurricane farther east than any other storm in recorded history, fueled by much warmer than usual ocean surface temperatures. A 2013 study in Geophysical Research Letters predicts human-fueled climate change will fuel more hurricanes than can survive long enough to make landfall in Europe. President Trump's name, former Texas environmental regulator and climate change denier Kathleen Hartnett White as a senior advisor on environmental policy. White served as chair of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality under then-Governor Rick Perry, who's now Trump's Secretary of Energy. White has argued that carbon dioxide is harmless and should not be regulated, has described solar and wind power as unreliable and parasitic, and has called climate change a dogma that has little to do with science. In a 2014 blog post titled Energy and Freedom, White wrote, "Coal dissolved the economic justification for slavery." In Louisiana, an oil rig exploded on Lake Pontchartrain north of New Orleans Sunday, injuring seven workers, five of them critically, leaving one person missing. Authorities say the rig burst into flames when cleaning chemicals ignited on the surface of the platform. It's not yet known whether the explosion caused any oil to spill. In Puerto Rico, the official death toll from the Hurricane Maria rose to 48 Saturday, but authorities warned the true toll could be far higher since power outages across the island have forced medical officials to rely on handwritten records rather than electronic data. This comes as residents desperate for drinking water have begun pumping Dorado groundwater contamination site, a hazardous waste Superfund site. The EPA warns the water contains chemicals that cause liver damage and an increased risk of cancer. About a third of Puerto Rico still lacks clean drinking water. And at least, close to 90% of the island's 3.4 million residents still lack electricity from the grid. Governor Ricardo Rosselló says he's pushing a plan to restore power to 95% of the grid by the end of December. Attorneys general from 19 U.S. states are suing the federal government after President Trump said he would cut off billions of dollars in federal subsidies to insurance companies that help cover low-income people's health care plans. Experts say ending the subsidies will dramatically increase insurance premiums, costs, and could unravel the health care market. This is New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman.
His effort to gut these subsidies with no warning or even a plan to contain the fallout is breathtakingly reckless. He has failed twice in efforts to legislatively repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. This is an effort simply to blow up the system. We will not allow President Trump to use New York families as political pawns in his dangerous partisan campaign to sabotage our health care system.
Iraq's army has begun an offensive aimed at seizing the northern city of Kirkuk from Kurdish Peshmerga fighters after voters in Iraq's Kurdish regions voted overwhelmingly for independence. A Kurdish commander said Monday his forces had retreated to positions outside the city of 1 million people as Iraqi forces moved in and also seized an oil company south of Kirkuk, adding that there were lots of casualties due to fighting. In Yemen, the World Health Organization's warning a cholera epidemic brought on by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war and naval blockade has become the largest and fastest spreading outbreak of the disease in modern world history. The World Health Organization says there are expected to be 1 million cases of cholera in Yemen by the end of the year, with at least 600,000 children likely to be affected. After headlines, we'll speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, who recently co-authored a New York Times op-ed headlined "Stop the Unconstitutional War in Yemen." In Guatemala, a court opened a new trial Friday for former U.S.-backed dictator Efrain Rios Montt on charges of genocide for a massacre in 1982 that killed 273 indigenous people, nearly half of them children. Rios Montt was found guilty of genocide in 2013, but a court annulled his 80-year sentence less than 2 weeks later. In Hollywood, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences voted Saturday to expel Harvey Weinstein following investigations by The New Yorker and The New York Times, which revealed a slew of rape and sexual assault allegations against the movie mogul. In a statement, the Academy said, quote, "The era of willful ignorance and shameful complicity in sexually predatory behavior and workplace harassment in our industry is over." The statement came as four more women stepped forward to accuse Weinstein of rape. Their British soap star, Lisette Anthony, Italian fashion model, Samantha Panagrosa, British actor, Alice Evans, and Miramax employee using the pseudonym Sarah Smith. Meanwhile, musician Courtney Love said over the weekend she was punished after she publicly warned women about Harvey Weinstein in 2005. This is Courtney Love being questioned that year at a red carpet event by the comedian Natasha Leggero.
Do you have any advice for a young girl moving to Hollywood?
I'll get live with us.
Harvey Weinstein invites you to a private party in the Four Seasons, don't you?
On Twitter, Courtney Love said that comment got her blacklisted by the powerful Hollywood talent agency, Creative Artists Agency, writing, quote, "Although I wasn't one of his victims, I was eternally banned by CAA for speaking out against Harvey Weinstein rape." Meanwhile, Amazon Studios says it has placed Chief Roy Price on an indefinite leave of absence following allegations of sexual harassment. Issa Hackett, a producer with the Amazon TV series Man in the High Castle, said Price sexually harassed her at the Comic-Con convention in 2015. A lawyer for a former contestant on Trump's reality TV show The Apprentice has subpoenaed Donald Trump's presidential campaign for all documents relating to her and any other women who've accused Trump of unwanted sexual contact. Summer Zervos accused Trump of repeatedly sexually assaulting her during a meeting in 2007, saying Trump kissed her on the lips, pressed his body against hers, groped her breasts, all without her consent. She was among a series of women who accused Trump of sexual assault during the 2016 campaign. Trump, in return, called Zervos and the other women liars. And former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick is suing the owners of NFL teams, charging they unlawfully colluded to keep him out of the league for taking a knee during the national anthem to protest police brutality and racial injustice. The lawsuit charges the owner secretly conspired to deprive Kaepernick of a job in violation of the NFL Players Union agreement. Kaepernick has remained unsigned since the 2016 season, even though he led the San Francisco 49ers to the Super Bowl in 2013 and is considered one of the league's best quarterbacks. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Yemen, where the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war and naval blockade has sparked a cholera epidemic that's become the largest and fastest-spreading outbreak of the disease in modern world history. There are expected to be 1 million cases of cholera in Yemen by the end of the year, with at least 600,000 children likely to be affected. This is UNICEF's Middle East Regional Director, Geert Kapeler.
Every day we have at least 5,000 to 10,000 newly reported cases throughout the country. That's unprecedented. But that requires also an unprecedented, massive response from the authorities here, but also from the international community.
The ongoing U.S.-backed Saudi-led bombing campaign has killed more than 10,000 civilians, sparked the cholera epidemic by destroying Yemen's health, water and sanitation systems, and exacerbated a famine that's left 7 million on the brink of starvation. The Saudi naval blockade has prevented food and medicine from reaching Yemeni civilians. Saudi Arabia launched its offensive in 2015 to target Houthi rebels, currently allied with longtime former leader Ali Abdullah Saleh. The U.S. has been a major backer of the Saudi-led war. Earlier this year, the Senate voted 53-47 to approve the sale of $500 million in precision-guided munitions to Saudi Arabia. The vote came just weeks after President Trump traveled to Saudi Arabia in his first foreign trip abroad as president. But in Washington, opposition to the U.S. support for the Saudi-led war is growing. A surprising number of lawmakers voted against the $500 million weapons deal earlier this year. And now lawmakers have introduced a constitutional resolution to withdraw all U.S. support for the war. In an op-ed piece for The New York Times, California Congressmember Ro Khanna, North Carolina Congressman Walter Jones, and Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan write they introduced the resolution, quote, in order to help put an end to the suffering of a country approaching a famine of biblical proportions. We believe the American people, if presented with the facts of this conflict, will oppose the use of their tax dollars to bomb and starve civilians, unquote. Well, to talk more about opposition to the U.S.-backed war in Yemen, we go to Palo Alto, California, to speak with Ro Khanna, Democratic congressmember from California, co-author of that New York Times piece headlined, Stop the Unconstitutional War in Yemen. Congressmember Khanna, welcome to Democracy Now! What are you demanding right now? Explain the scope, the gravity of the crisis in Yemen.
Well, thank you for calling attention to this issue, because it needs far more attention in the media. As you mentioned, there is a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. There is an outbreak of cholera of unprecedented numbers, almost 1 million people who are going to be affected, a famine of nearly 7 million. Yemenese citizens aren't getting basic food. They aren't getting sanitation. And it's because of the Saudi campaign. And unfortunately, we have been aiding Saudi Arabia. We have been refueling Saudi planes. We've been assisting Saudi Arabia with targeting. And none of this has been approved by the United States Congress. So we invoked the War Powers Resolution, which says very simply, Congress needs to vote on our actions in Yemen. And we hope both Republicans and Democrats will vote to stop our assistance to Saudi Arabia in a campaign that has violated human rights.
What exactly would that mean? Stopping arms sales to Saudi Arabia?
Very clearly that we should not be in any way refueling Saudi planes. If we stop refueling these Saudi planes, it would make it much harder for Saudi Arabia to bomb civilians in Yemen. It means we should stop coordinating with Saudi Arabia in targeting any civilians. Now, I asked Secretary Mattis on the House Armed Services Committee whether we were still doing these things, and he said that we are not. But up till recent reports, there was activity of our refueling or our assisting in targeting. And we want to make it very, very clear going forward that this should not continue. And that's what this resolution would do.
Earlier this month, the UN report said 683 children in Yemen were killed or injured by the Saudi-led coalition in 2016. Amnesty International and other rights groups criticized the UN report for underplaying the role of the Saudi-led coalition in human rights violations in Yemen, while Saudi Arabia rejected the findings as inaccurate and misleading. This is Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the UN, Abdullah Al-Mualimi.
We exercise the maximum degree of care and precaution to avoid civilian harm. The regrettable effects of this conflict are a direct result of the Houthi and forces loyal to former President Saleh, use of immoral and illegal actions that put the civilian population at risk, including using children as human shields, and their continued grave violations in this regard with impunity and no accountability. These heinous acts by the Houthis and their allies are committed to advance their goals and objectives in complete disregard to the sanctity of human life. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the coalition reaffirm that we are taking important measures to protect civilians during all military operations, to end the suffering of the Yemeni people and minimize humanitarian cost.
That's the Saudi ambassador to the United Nations. Your response to this, Congressman Khanna?
Well, it's propaganda, and every human rights group that has looked at this knows that the Saudis have been indiscriminate in some of the bombing of civilians. Look, the Houthi rebels aren't of clean hands, and they're not blameless in the conflict. But the Saudis have made this argument that most of the famine and cholera are in areas that the Houthis control. And that's just a false and misleading, because the reality is, yes, the Houthis may be controlling those areas, but the reason that the famine is taking place is because the Saudis aren't allowing food or medicine to go in there, and the Saudis are bombing those areas. So what we're saying is the United States, one, has no stake in helping Saudi Arabia get another regime in. It's a proxy war there with Iran. And what we need is a diplomatic solution and humanitarian assistance. And we certainly shouldn't be picking sides and aiding Saudi Arabia in their bombings.
I want to ask you about the extent of U.S. military involvement in the war in Yemen. This is the former deputy director of the CIA, Michael Morell, speaking on the Charlie Rose Show last month.
As we sit here and speak, there are U.S. special forces on the ground in Yemen. They were put there by the Trump administration to support what the Saudis and the Emiratis are doing there. That is supporting our allies, and it is pushing back on what the Iranians are trying to achieve in Yemen.
So that's the former deputy director of the CIA, Michael Morell, saying there are U.S. special forces on the ground in Yemen. Congressman Khanna, can you comment on this? What's the role of these special forces there?
Well, if you talk to military leaders, they will tell you that some of our forces there are engaged in counterterrorism operations against al-Qaeda. And that's why our resolution makes it very clear. The resolution does nothing to restrict any potential counterterrorism operations against al-Qaeda. But what it says is we can't have any of our military forces or special forces coordinating with Saudi Arabia in a civil war to try to overthrow the Houthis rebels. And Saudi Arabia is actually aligned with al-Qaeda in this. What we see here is the United States taking Saudi's side as a counter to Iran. This type of balance of power calculations have gotten us in trouble in the past. And my perspective and some of my colleagues is our first principle should be do no harm, to have greater restraint in our foreign policy, not to try to pick winners and losers or side with one foreign power over another, where we've had a history of actually doing more harm in the Middle East and in the greater world.
Congressman Khanna, your New York Times op-ed headline is Stop the Unconstitutional War in Yemen begins, imagine the entire population of Washington state, 7.3 million people, were on the brink of starvation, with the port city of Seattle under a naval and aerial blockade, leaving it unable to receive and distribute countless tons of food and aid that sit waiting offshore. You go on to say this nightmare scenario is akin to the obscene reality occurring in the Middle East's poorest country, Yemen, at the hands of the region's richest, Saudi Arabia, with unyielding United States military support that Congress has not authorized and that therefore violates the Constitution. President Trump's first foreign trip anywhere abroad was to Saudi Arabia. Of course, that followed President Obama, who went there a number of times, I think 4 times. Can you talk about this relationship? One of the closest allies of the United States is Saudi Arabia.
Well, we need to reorient this relationship, and Senator Bernie Sanders gave a speech recently talking about that. And the question is, do human rights matter? Are we going to stand up for basic human rights and basic values? And in the past, the United States has, in this area, taken a view that let's just balance Iran, and it doesn't matter what Saudi Arabia is doing. If they're opposed to Iran, we should be for them. But this has led to, of course, a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And here's the thing, if you talk to ordinary Americans, and if they were to know what we were doing, they would be appalled. They would not want us aiding the Saudis in bombing civilians in Yemen, and they certainly don't think the United States has a stake in a fight against the Houthis or in a proxy war against Iran. And so what this resolution is doing is actually bringing this for a debate. That's why the War Powers Act said it has to be Congress that makes these decisions, because Congress is more accountable to people.
I wanted to ask you about where you are now, Palo Alto, California, and, of course, the district you represent. I wanted to ask you about the fires, which we're going to go into more deeply in our next segment with a UCLA climate scientist. But this year's hurricane striking with historic force, the 10th hurricane this year, Ophelia just named. There haven't been 10 hurricanes in one season since 1893. And then the uncontrolled wildfires raging where you are across Northern California, including your district. At least 40 people killed, thousands of homes gone, hundreds of people still missing. Scientists finding a direct link between climate change and the fires. But the network TV meteorologists have barely uttered the words climate change. And President Trump says he's withdrawing the U.S. from the landmark Paris Climate Accord. Congressmember Khanna, what do you think needs to be done right now?
Well, it's heartbreaking. As I landed back home, you could actually smell the smoke landing into San Francisco Airport, and the stories of elderly couples, some of them who have passed away because they couldn't evacuate. We know, in part, the cause of these fires, the Diablo winds and coupled with extreme heat in the summer has led to some of the biggest fires in California history. Now, scientists may not say definitively that climate change caused the Diablo winds or the extreme heat conditions, but what they will tell you is these are the types of extreme climate conditions that lead to tragedy. And we ought to take heed and say we want to prevent these type of extreme climate conditions here in California going forward, given that we see the extraordinary devastating impact. Look, I represent Silicon Valley, a place of extraordinary technology, but these type of events are reminders of our own the limits of human power, the sense that nature and the planet still matter, and they should give us a sense of humility that we should not chance the fate of the planet, that we can't control in the environmental catastrophes caused by extreme climate conditions.
We're going to go to this more extended discussion in a moment, but I did want to ask you about Kevin DeLeon, California Senate pro tem, announcing yesterday that he will be running for Senator Dianne Feinstein's seat, running against her. Your thoughts on this, saying he's going to represent a wing of the party that has been really iced out?
Well, I had called for a challenge to Senator Feinstein. She has been wrong on the major issues of our time. She was a supporter of the war in Iraq. She has supported a neocon, neoliberal interventionist foreign policy in Libya or increasing troops in Afghanistan. She was for the extension of the Patriot Act and for mass surveillance and worked with Republicans to have that mass surveillance. We need someone who is going to be for a progressive foreign policy, who's going to stand up for civil liberties. And I think Kevin DeLeon can certainly do that. There may be others who enter, but I just think California is one of the most innovative, progressive places, and we need someone who's going to articulate those values.
Ro Khanna, we want to thank you for being with us. Have you formally endorsed him?
I have. I have endorsed Kevin. I think he has done terrific work on the environment, and he's done terrific work on health care for all. But like I said, my bigger theme is I like Kevin. I'm supporting him. But I want to see new progressive ideas come forward from California. And I respect Senator Feinstein, but she's just been wrong on some of the biggest issues of our time. And given my own perspective on foreign policy and civil liberties, I don't think she's the right voice for California going forward.
Well, Ro Khanna, I want to thank you for being with us. Democratic member of Congress recently co-authored an op-ed that we'll link to called Stop the Unconstitutional War in Yemen. When we come back, climate change and the wildfires of Northern California. Stay with us. Ivan Karamazov, a musician from Sonoma County, who sent us that song from Northern California. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go to California, where raging wildfires fueled by fires have raged at least have killed at least 40 people, destroyed thousands of homes and businesses, and scorched more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. The fires are now the deadliest in California since record-keeping began. At least 100,000 people have been forced to evacuate, with about 75,000 still displaced. Some residents had to flee for their lives as drought conditions and powerful erratic winds have contributed to the explosive spread of fires. This is CAL FIRE Chief Ken Pimlott.
We are still impacted by 5 years of drought. With the significant rain that we had last winter, those effects are gone of that moisture, and we are literally looking at explosive vegetation. These fires are burning actively during the day and at night when one would expect a fire to subside. And make no mistake, this is a serious, critical, catastrophic event.
More than 11,000 firefighters are battling the wildfires with the support of hundreds of fire engines, dozens of helicopters and planes. Many of the firefighters are prisoners who are working for as little as a dollar a day. Among the victims of the wildfires were elderly residents of Sonoma County, where authorities say their bodies were so charred the only way to identify some of them was by the serial numbers on artificial joints or other medical devices. The fires have also contributed to a housing crisis, leaving thousands homeless in neighborhoods of California where rental prices were already sky high before the blazes. For more, we go to California, where we're joined by two guests. In Los Angeles, Daniel Swain joins us, climate scientist at UCLA, author of Weather West, the California weather blog. And via Democracy Now! Video stream, we're joined by Jan Hoyman, an artist who had to flee her home to escape the fire in Mendocino County last week. Let's go right now to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Daniel Swain. Talk about the fires and whether you believe there's a connection to climate change.
Well, thanks for having me. The scope of the wildfires that we've been seeing over the past week or so in Northern California is really kind of sobering. As you mentioned, I think these fires have the highest death toll and the highest number of structures burned of any series of fires in California history. And California does have a long history of deadly and destructive wildfires. And the fires we've seen this week have bear some similarities to the historical fires that have caused big problems in the past, which is the presence of these very strong and dry land-to-sea winds known locally as the Diablo winds. And when these winds blow, the autumn tends to be the time of year when they occur. They can cause existing fires to spread very, very quickly, in some cases, I think, faster than people have been able to outrun them, unfortunately. And the climate conditions over the past several months in California have been, in some ways, unprecedented. California just experienced its record warmest summer, which comes immediately on the heels of what was quite a wet winter, actually. And counterintuitively, that sequence, that transition from very wet winter to record hot summer, may have actually contributed to a significant degree to the fire risk that we've been seeing by increasing the amount of grass and dry brush that grew during the winter and spring, and then leading to an unprecedented amount of vegetation drying over the past several months.
There are also wildfires raging in Spain and Portugal. What is the connection?
Well, one of the interesting things about all these locations is they tend to have similar climates. They have what are known as Mediterranean climates. And from a fire perspective, that's important because these regions tend to have long, dry summers, even under natural climate conditions. The challenging part is that recently those summers have become longer and drier, and the fire season in many of these parts of the world that were already susceptible to wildfire are experiencing longer burning seasons and hotter, drier summers.
Can you talk about how wildfires should be dealt with in the future, and what can be the approach to climate change that can make a difference here?
Well, you know, wildfire and global warming sort of represents an interesting example of a natural hazard that in places like California or really anywhere with a Mediterranean climate with high fire risk, where there is a significant degree of pre-existing risk. That people who live in these regions and people who plan, do hazard planning in these regions are well aware of. But the warming temperatures aggravate this existing risk and in some cases make it considerably worse than it would have been otherwise. And so, you know, in some ways, the same sorts of adaptations that we make to wildfires in general will still apply to the wildfires of the future. That may include being careful where we build our homes and urban areas, and you know, thinking more carefully about what we do and how we manage fires once they occur. But on the bigger scale, the changes in climate that we're experiencing are largely due to the human emission of greenhouse gases. And we expect warming to continue for as long as we continue to emit those greenhouse gases. And so there's both a challenge and an opportunity here where if we choose to reduce and eventually to eliminate our greenhouse gas emissions, we will avert much of the warming, much of the increased risk of extreme events like wildfires that otherwise would have occurred. And right now, we're starting to see signs of heading on that trajectory, at least internationally, but we're still not quite where we need to be to be on the right track to eventually level off that risk.
Last week, Democracy Now! Spoke with Park Williams, a climate scientist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. I asked him about the failure of network TV meteorologists to make the connection between extreme weather and climate change.
I think it's because the term global warming and the term climate change have been politicized. But in the circles that I work with real climatologists who are working on these issues every day, there's no hesitation to use those terms. As you put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the globe warms, whether it's the Earth or another planet. It's just a law of physics. And so it is surprising to see trained meteorologists on TV steer away from those terms.
That's climate scientist Park Williams. I wanted to turn to Jan Hoyman now, who is in Ukiah in Northern California, a pottery artist who narrowly escaped the fire in Mendocino County last week. Jan, thanks so much for being with us. Can you describe what happened to you?
Okay. I awoke Monday morning really early. I'm not sure what time, to the sound of a locomotive, but then there were the pops of propane tanks exploding. I smelled smoke. I looked out the window, and I knew the fire was right there, right next to me. I grabbed my dog, and I'm in my nightgown. As I'm running to my car, my neighbor is coming down the hill with, I live remotely, coming down the hill, honking her horn. I jump in my car, go down the ranch road, and there she is. Her car is stuck in the road. She jumped in with her four kids. Now the flames are 20 to 30 feet tall on both sides of our ranch driveway. Everything's on fire. We're trying to get out to the main road. There is a pine tree down in the middle of the road on fire. Instead of turning around, we back up and go very quickly, as fast as we can, to a place where we can then try to go across the vineyards. They were on fire. We turned and started to go uphill back towards her house. When we were about halfway up to her house, and maybe the road is 2 miles long, and then we could start to breathe a little bit easier. The kids were nice and calm the whole time. The fire wasn't all around us at this point. We did get to her home, and her husband and the four kids, Charlotte and I, jumped into their four-wheel drive trucks and drove to another spot. I have hiked to this spot many times, but I could not have found it in the dark. She and her husband were just the savior for me at this point. I helped them by getting the kids in the car. They helped me by getting to Rattlesnake Rock. We then hiked in the dark with the kids, flashlights in hand, up and down a ravine a couple of times to another neighbor's house. And this is maybe 3/4 mile away. Now the fire is farther down in the valley, but we can see it encroaching, coming closer. Her husband found a four-wheeler in the shed of the neighbor who had left days earlier. There were keys in the ignition. We were quite lucky about that. He found a trailer to put behind it, and now all seven of us drove down the road on the four-wheeler. We're watching the fire come up the mountainside at this point. We get to another neighbor's house. They're watching the fire, and they don't know if they're going to evacuate. We have a flat tire, but one of the young men kindly took us in his truck to Willits. Now, driving, we hiked out, but to drive to Willits usually takes about a half an hour if you have clear roads. So we wound our way on the back mountainous roads to the Willits evacuation center, which was the police station, the community
Jan,
center.
Was there a mandatory evacuation in your area? I think what people don't understand who are not experiencing these fires is how fast they come up. Why hadn't you left until the point when you did? That's what I think a lot of people can't understand.
That's a great question. Well, my electricity was out, and my cell phone wasn't working. And that's how I received messages through my cell phone. When the electricity went down and the cell towers went down because the fire was moving so quickly, there was no way to let people know how quickly they needed to move. Yes, there was mandatory evacuation, but I had no idea that that was happening. You know, to rely on the cell phone system to let people know what's happening is really a faulty idea, at least in our area, because the towers go down.
Do you think state and local officials should have done more, and what do you think should happen at the federal level?
You know, I cannot make a comment on that because I'm just the person here living, and I know that there's so many different complicated issues around it. Yes, I think in general we need to prepare more for these kind of catastrophes. And my personal opinion is that we as a community, the ranch I live on had about 20 different homes on it and scattered around about 1,000 acres. And I think we as a small community need to try to investigate and put together a system that we can warn each other.
And do you know if your home still exists?
My home is melted, basically. I had stucco walls and a metal roof, and maybe there's parts of it standing, but really there's no home left. I do have some photographs that a neighbor took. I haven't been allowed back into the area. There's still mandatory evacuation.
And let me turn to the climate scientist, Daniel Swain. How toxic is the ash, is the smoke in these areas?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert in the composition of wildfire smoke, but, you know, the smoke in these fires, you have to remember, especially when they burn through populated areas, it isn't just wood smoke and particulate matter from the brush and grass, as you'd get during a truly wildfire. What you're also getting is compounds that are combusting in people's homes and businesses that are burning as well. And so you have this, what must be a pretty volatile mix of stuff up there in these plumes when they start burning urban areas.
Well, Daniel Swain, I want to thank you for joining us from UCLA, climate scientist in Los Angeles. And Jan Hoyman, all the best to you, your community. Thank God you escaped. Jan Hoyman, an artist who escaped the fire in Mendocino County. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, who is a black identity extremist, and why is the federal government putting out reports on them? Stay with us.
If all I was black, looking at you, you might look past all the love I give. Natural gifts,
got natural gifts,
got perspective,
got perspective,
might make your shift
the way you look it in.
I've got love, got love. If all I did was cry, if all that feeling got left behind, I'd worry about you.
What's in your mind?
Mavis Staples of All I Was Black. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show by looking at a leaked FBI counterterrorism memo, which claims so-called black identity extremists pose a threat to law enforcement. That's according to Foreign Policy magazine, which obtained the document written by the FBI's Domestic Terrorism Analysis Unit. The memo was dated August 3, 2017, only days before the deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where white supremacists, Ku Klux Klan members, neo-Nazis killed an anti-racist protester. Heather Heyer injured dozens more. But the report is not concerned with the violent threat of white supremacists. Instead, the memo reads, the FBI assesses its very likely black identity extremist perceptions of police brutality against African Americans spurred an increase in premeditated retaliatory lethal violence against law enforcement and will very likely serve as justification for such violence. violence, end quote. Civil liberties groups have slammed the FBI report, warning the black identity extremist designation threatens the rights of protesters with Black Lives Matter and other groups. Many have also compared the memo to the FBI's covert COINTELPRO program of the 50s through 70s, which targeted the civil rights movement. For more, we're going to San Francisco, California, where we're joined by Makir Cyril. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Center for Media Justice, as well as a Black Lives Matter Bay Area activist. Malkia, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about this report and what your assessment is of this term they have used, black identity extremist?
Well, thanks for having me. You know, it's a great question. What is a black identity extremist? I think we're all trying to figure that out. Nobody knows, in part because it doesn't exist. It's a term fabricated by the FBI, constructed, and it has a history. I mean, for a very long time, for many decades in this country, probably centuries, the FBI has criminalized black dissent. We saw it in through the COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, as you mentioned, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. We're seeing it again today. This term, this idea of black extremism coming up by the FBI, being used as a way to criminalize democratically protected speech and activity. It's wrong, it's erroneous, and it should be withdrawn.
So what is your understanding of where it stands now?
You know, right now, we don't know. I mean, that's part of the problem. You know, we need some information from the FBI. It's clear that the FBI should provide an unredacted description. What do they mean by a black identity extremist? Right now, that description is pretty vague. It refers to some anti-white ideologies. It compares, you know, it talks about the ideologies of black separatism, but it doesn't have anything concrete. I mean, I think that's part of the problem, that this is a categorization that has been constructed. The definition makes no sense, and we need some more information from the FBI so that we can actually respond effectively to this categorization.
It doesn't refer to Black Lives Matter specifically. Can you talk about that, Malkia?
Well, I mean, you know, it doesn't refer to any specific organization because the FBI, through its own guidelines, can't really do that, number one. Number two, its guidelines say it can't start investigations or investigate anyone solely on the basis of race. So what it's done is it's constructed out of, you know, looking at six different cases over 3 years that have absolutely nothing to do with each other of people who have committed violence against police officers. They have constructed a relationship between these cases that doesn't exist, and then assigned some political ideology to those cases that doesn't exist. So anti-white feelings or sentiment doesn't lead to police violence. Being angry as a black person in America about the doesn't lead to violence against police. Being angry about police violence in America, police violence that is targeting largely people of color, also does not lead to violence against the police. So the bottom line here is that we have a rampant situation where white nationalism is on the rise. And yet the FBI has chosen to use its resources to construct and fabricate a threat that does not exist instead of addressing a threat that does exist. So whether it refers directly to Black Lives Matter as an organization or not, it's clear. This is an attempt to criminalize black dissent, which will have an outsized negative impact on those who are working in organizations like Black Lives Matter.
I wanted to ask you about another issue, about these allegations. A Russian company spent more than $100,000 buying thousands of ads that sought to politicize the U.S. electorate ahead of the 2016 presidential election. Some of the allegations relate to Russian Facebook ads specifically referencing Black Lives Matter, targeting audiences in Baltimore and Ferguson, Missouri. Meanwhile, yes. Google also says, quote, suspected Russian agents, unquote, paid for tens of thousands of dollars worth of political advertisements last year, also aimed at swaying the 2016 presidential election. Your thoughts?
First of all, we have to be really clear. This is not simply about what Russia has done. This is about how Russia and the right wing of the United States has collaborated to undermine democracy. So I want to be very clear. When we talk about, you know, Russia buying these ads or using these Facebook pages, so on and so forth, what we're really talking about is a collusion, a collaboration between a global right wing. That's really important. We need to be really clear about that, number one. Number two, whether the ads or the Facebook pages, seem to be pro or anti Black Lives Matter, the fact is that these pages and these ads were anti-Black. That's what's clear. They were using anti-Black tropes of Black militancy to sway and to sway an election and undermine democracy. This is not new. The CIA has done this for decades. This is a tactic that has been used by the United States internationally for decades. We should not be surprised that it is being used now. And we need to think very carefully about what is going to happen over the next several years to undermine the next presidential election. And we need to get ready.
I wanted to ask you about a CNN report. A social media campaign calling itself Blacktivist and linked to the Russian government used both Facebook and Twitter in an apparent attempt to amplify racial tensions during the election. Again, they attribute it to two sources with knowledge of the matter talking to CNN. The Twitter account has been handed over to Congress. The Facebook account is expected to be handed over in the coming days, was the report. Your response to Blacktivist, have you looked into this?
You know, I've heard about it. I've actually seen the page in the past. I spend a lot of time working on social media issues and looking at possibly fake pages that talk about Black issues, trying to weed them out from pages that are related to real on-the-ground organizations. And what we've seen is, interestingly, while this has come to light, you know, the Blacktivist page has come to light as being associated with this disinformation campaign, it's clear that this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are dozens of fake pages on Facebook, dozens of fake accounts on Twitter that claim to be related to some Black movement, but in fact are not. What we need to be is very careful, making sure that the pages we follow, the accounts we follow, are actually connected to real organizations that are doing real work on the ground. And it's hard to do. It means that Facebook and Twitter have to take real responsibility for this kind of disinformation on their site, really do something to protect Black activists who are working on their site, and differentiate between the fake pages and the real pages, because it has real consequences for Black activism.
Malky Asiro, for young people who may not be familiar with COINTELPRO, you certainly are. Can you talk about your own family experience? We have just about a minute. December 4th, 1969, Mark Clark and Fred Hampton, the head of the Black Panthers in Chicago, Illinois, are gunned down by police as they're sleeping in bed. What the counterintelligence program did and the effect, for example, on your family?
My mother was a member of the Black Panther Party in New York. She ran the breakfast program in New York. And my mother was visited by the FBI just weeks before she died in 2005. So this is not something, this harassment, the kind of FBI harassment of Black activists didn't end in 1969. It didn't end when COINTELPRO was exposed in 1971. It is continuing today. There are hundreds of political prisoners in our prison system, Black political prisoners, Puerto Rican political prisoners, Native American political prisoners, because of the counterintelligence program. And we need to make sure that never, ever happens in America again.
Malkia Cyril, thanks so much for taking this time with us, co-founder and executive director of the Center for Media Justice, also a Black Lives Matter activist. That does it for our broadcast today. Happy birthday to Miguel Noguera. Happy belated birthday, Miguel. Democracy Now! Is produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Amel Ahmed, and Nat Needham. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Check our website for transcripts and podcasts.